I'm Nick Ristad. I'm a chaplain now at Napa State Hospital, which is a mental hospital in California. Most of you probably heard of Napa, Sonoma Wine. That's right in the middle of that country. Beautiful campus-like place where we have about 300 criminally committed people now because the prison system is exploding and overflowing. I read in the U.S. news and paper the other day that there's 83,000 people in the state of California system. Yesterday I gave a lot of statistics and talked a little bit about prison and gave a little bit about my background. Do you need some of that this morning? There was your whole new crew here. How many people were here yesterday? Oh my. I have been involved in prison ministry for about 30 years. Started out with an internship at San Quentin and then had a parish that was in a rundown area of Fresno, poor whites, blacks, Chicanos, and had members of my parish that were in the juvenile system and the prison system, and kept on with that and intended after the San Quentin experience to end up in prison myself. And so waited for that opportunity and went to a prison called Vacaville, or California Medical Facility, which is one of the two now only stated that I know of. There may be some others, but that I know of, specifically mental hospital prisons, where people went for treatment and therapy. And so I've been involved in that kind of angle with the prison ministry, and have been on the State Advisory Committee for Institutional Religion, which handles all the religious stuff in the state system, for about 15 years, and have been president of all the state chaplains for a number of years, and also was on the coordinating committee for the California Department of Corrections religious program for a number of years, and now I'm on that coordinating committee for the mental hospital system. So that's briefly some of the things that I've done. Some other things, set up a halfway house for ex-convicts with the Salvation Army and done a few other things. But yesterday we talked about some of the makeup of prison and the statistics and how much it costs and all that kind of stuff. And today my intent was to talk about what kind of people go to prison. The clinical definitions of those people are sociopath, psychopath, character disorder, borderline personality structure. And that basically is all kind of mixed up in saying the same thing. If there's any clinicians here, you probably have some awareness of this. And I brought along, I think there's only 12 of each of these. I didn't expect this turnout. I'm not used to that. Most people are not interested in this. The church is on the periphery of this and really not very interested in it. Have any of you... assuming that most of you are Lutherans, read about Vern Fleschner and his struggle of being fired at the Washington State Prison. Vern is an acquaintance of mine, and I was on the verge of being fired once from the activities that I was doing, and I advised him about the kind of things that he could expect and what was going to happen in that thing, and I said that he would be lucky if he was fired, because he immediately... if he agreed to go through the procedures of filing suit, he had his future made in terms of security of money. That he would win that suit without any problem at all, but it would be a very emotionally expensive and costly kind of experience for him, and he needed to decide about that. And I warned him about the press and also about the church and some other people who would be using him as this thing unfolded, and about the ignorance of people involved in that kind of a struggle and the kind of stuff that would probably happen to them. We're very ignorant about prison, intentionally so, because we don't want to look at it, and purposely, because the prison systems, state, federal, whatever they are, county, intentionally want to keep us out and ignorant in a way, and the best way to do that is to keep information away from us. What you don't know, you can't talk about. What you're not aware of, you can't be involved with. And they also try to hype up the violence and the barbarity of prison so that you won't want to go there. So it works pretty well, because most of us don't know anything about it. So what I'm sharing with you is my experience of the last 30 years of being involved with the system that is our system that we intentionally want and intentionally create and thrive off of in terms of vicariously living off the exploits of the people that we put there and reading about them. And there was an issue yesterday that I read this morning, or the day before yesterday, about, I don't know if you saw the U.S., what's that called, U.S. paper?
U.S.
No, not the magazine, but
USA
Today. There was a whole thing on Charlie in there. And he keeps being reintroduced to us and causes a lot of excitement and fantasy and all that kind of stuff in us. For some good reasons and for bad reasons. As Scott mentioned, Charlie was a parishioner of mine, and I knew him very well. He worked for me for 4 years, and I was instrumental in helping him get out of isolation and that kind of business. Without going into pastoral confidentiality of who he is, just to say that I liked him a good deal. And he's not what purports to be in the press, because the first thing that you should know about that is everything that's put in the press is put there to sell. Everything in the media is there to sell, and so the bias of the media is to always to glamorize and sensationalize everything they put in there. So, and it's hard for us to recognize that at times and to screen that stuff out. And then. Given the propensity of Charlie to be like a child and somewhat delinquent and liking attention, who of us doesn't like attention? And being locked away and needing attention, he will dramatize some things just to create some excitement for himself. Anyway, that probably a good jump off. There are 12 of these, two different forms of talking about the psychopathic mind and psychopathic checklist. I don't quite know what to do. There's so many of you, I don't quite know what to do except to say I'll pass one out this way, and you can pass one out this way, and you can take a look at it and share it with your neighbors. And if you're interested in it, I assume there's Xerox equipment around here that I'd be happy to then, you know, get some more Xerox things of those. And if there are any of you here who are...
Well, just to say, Nick, the Xerox is broken today, and maybe what you can do is keep one set and we'll put it in the reference library.
Oh, all right.
People can go in there and
sure.
Get it there.
Fine, thank you. And then to say that... for any of you who are clinicians or whose avocation is psychology, I have a much greater detailed stuff on this that I think, frankly, confuses me some. But it's full of all the Latin scientific psychological jargon of what it means to be psychopathic or sociopathic or character disorder. And with a couple papers written in the back of them by a fellow by the name of Malloy. To show you the struggle that the scientific community has had with the psychopathic mind, there is, until Malloy has come along. Malloy came to Napa last month to talk to the staff, because Napa now is getting these kinds of people there, and so they're trying to train the staff, and that's partly, I think, why when I competed for the job at Napa after being at Vacaville for 17 years, they accepted me wanted me as the chaplain, because I was aware of this kind of stuff, and they knew this was going to invade their society there, and they wanted somebody around who had some familiarity with it. So he came and talked. I have some interns every year, and I was telling them the day before about what they may expect from Malloy. and said to them, in all these years, there has only been one definitive book on the psychopathic mind, and that's a book called The Mask of Sanity by Cleckley. And that was put out, I think, in the early 50s. Now, you can see that all the other fields of our science have exploded and come along quite generously, where this is just starting to be understood. And I also said that in all my experience in working at Vacaville with the therapeutic community there, which was filled with, we had all kinds of crazy kind of psychological stuff going on there. It was really fun to be around. They had go-karts there and all kinds of stuff to stimulate the men. And all the anomalies of the California prison system came there. And then on top of the anomalies came people that were diagnosed as probably potentially amenable to treatment. So there was all kinds of therapy going on, all kinds of different forms. But that in my experience of dealing with many of the psychiatrists and the psychologists there who were just coming in as novices or hired at Vacaville, that many of them didn't know anything about the psychopathic mind. They knew a lot about schizophrenia and psychosis and neurosis and manic depressives, but they didn't know anything about psychopathy. And that the presumptions and assumptions that they had were going to be and were rudely shattered, and that some of them became so disturbed and upset by it that they quit. And that one of the things that I saw happening over and over again was that the young therapeutic staff would be coming in there, and group therapy was the therapy of not only choice, but of almost economics. That's the way you could deal with the most people in the quickest way. Was that they would talk to the inmates and tell the inmates about, you know, well, you don't have to do this kind of behavior, and you don't have to act this way, and you guys are getting healthy, and you can do this, and you can do that. And then what happens in the prison system normally, when a person starts getting healthy, they stop acting out in terms of aggressive behavior, and in terms of preying behavior on other people, and in terms of self aggrandizing behavior and self-emulating, getting all kinds of stuff coming at them and being on stage. And they start becoming introspective. And I could see that because I had a large, between the two chapels, there was this large garden area. And these guys would start all of a sudden sniffing around, coming down to the chapel, and what's going on down here? And, you know, does God really live here? And does the chaplain really know anything about God? And who is God anyway? And what's she up to? And what are the flowers out in the garden all about? And what does life mean? And so I could tell that something then was, some internalized stuff was starting to take place with them. And I would just wait till they approached me, or, you know, say hello to them, and they would connect or not connect. But the other thing that would happen was they would stop playing cops and robbers. And I say this to you because it's a very graphic illustration of what we do in society with criminals. We also play cops and robbers with street people. And we don't recognize this game that we play. It's an exhilarating game for all of us. It's hide and seek. Seek and find. It's Red Rover, Red Rover. It's all the kind of chase games that we as kids like to play. And if you aren't too far away from your childhood, you can remember how you love to chase and you love to be chased. And then that turned into boy-girl stuff. And the exhilaration of that chase and what that chase means. Well, when you give up that chase and you give up that exhilaration, some internalizing, some maturity starts happening in you. Now, some of us never give that up. I mean, we still need the chase, and we find the chase in different ways. The competition, we get into competition, or we So, and I'm not saying that's necessarily bad. I'm just talking about the experience of that, and how you channel that experience of being chased and of chasing. And we continue to do that, and that's partly what the papers sensationalize. They talk about the latest chase, and the latest chasee, and the latest chaser, and how, you know, the chaser killed 15 people, and then how the police chased after him, and they got him. And, or, you know, the build-up, you know, the latest one in California was Salcido, who chased around and killed his family and killed some other people, and then chased off to Mexico, and then where was he, and how are we going to get him, and then they got him, and then brought him back, and there's always the latest crime. That's the other thing that encourages the chase feeling in us. There's always the latest crime in the paper. And the thing that I'd ask you to reflect on is, how do you feel about those latest crimes? What is your response to that person that is being chased? Most of our common response to that is, kill a fucker. Boy, let's get that son of a bitch. And I hope he gets it in the end. Now, that's the kind of feeling, I submit to you, that keeps prison going. That's the kind of feeling that keeps us having the need to have the chase and the chaser. And that's the kind of need that needs us, that keeps us out of the understanding of what forgiveness is about, and of always needing people like Geraldo Rivera to interview whoever it is on TV and do what I call this despicable pornographic violence that is really worse than any of the TV shoot 'em ups, because it incorporates inside us a thing that we feel is true and that we accept as valid and that we encourage them by saying, yes, that guy should go to jail for life, and if he doesn't go to jail for life, they ought to kill him. And I submit to you that those feelings are evil, and that those feelings are the kind of things that generate hatred and rejection and the disassociation of ourself from another human being. And that that's part of the psychopathic mind. That we are part of that psychopathic mind when we succumb to that kind of feeling and that kind of thinking. Let's see, I'm off. I get confused a lot because there's lots of things happening here that I think about as I'm going along. Well, do you have any responses? Please feel free to interrupt me.
How do you avoid that?
I think I'd like to. That's a key question. I'd like to avoid that right now, because tomorrow I want to talk about the religious dimension of this, and that's the key. Is, how do you love your neighbor as yourself? How do you have empathy? And how, but at the same time recognizing that you're not your neighbor. That most of you here are probably not psychopaths. There may be one or two here. On the other hand, I also want to say to you, and I have not read Norman Mailer, so I'm not saying he's an authority on anything. I'm just saying that Norman Mailer has said, I don't know where I picked it up, that our country is a country of sociopathic behavior, that we're all a bunch of sociopaths. Now let's try and define that term and get away from the jargon of that. The jargon doesn't help us in any way. It's theological jargon doesn't help us. Neither does sociopath or psychopath or character disorder. That stuff that just confuses. But we got to label it, you know. It helps to say, okay, this is kind of what it is. Let's see if I can draw something here. Now maybe I could just put a line. I just put a line like that. At one end is the extreme form of the person who does not identify or associate or feel into other people at all and treats himself and others as objects. I say him at this point because it's mainly hims that we're dealing with. There are very few she's in this kind of stuff, which is a rather intriguing kind of a thing to think about. Why aren't there more she's on this line? And then there's a person down here who is empathetic and able to identify and feels connection and symbiotic relationships with everybody, maybe to a neurotic degree so that they can become immobilized in their function. They can't move without feeling they're hurting or interfacing with the community around them in such deep levels that it's hard for them to relate, you know, without becoming very kind of psychotic and dysfunctional. And these people probably, and I say this just out of my own experience again, I'm not a clinician, right, and everything I'm telling you is not gospel except for my experience. These people are probably, if you know anything about the Myers-Briggs test, which seems to be so popular today, are probably INFPs, that they feel and sense and see and have too much sensory awareness. And if they don't develop some kind of screening and some kind of ability to cope with that, become immobilized. I was at Pendle Hill. I don't know if any of you know about Pendle Hill. It's a Quaker retreat center in Pennsylvania, and I went there for a year to get some of my sanity back after being in prison for 17 years. And didn't realize how kind of burned out and kind of psychotic I might have been, because I got there and I was not able to really function well for almost 9 weeks. I mean, I just kind of collapsed and slept and walked and was a recluse. I'm a very high I introvert, and discovered then, and when I was there anyway, Catherine Myers of the Myers-Briggs relationship was there, and she was doing these kind of things, and I did some tests with her. She was very intrigued because I am an INFP. I thought it was something else. And she was just amazed at how could I work in prison, and she was an INFP, and she said most men who are INFPs, two things happen to them. They become immobilized and intimidated by the world, and are perceived as being very, quote, negative term here, not necessarily negative, effeminate, and unable to function in the world and get beat down by the world, or they commit suicide. She said that's a typical pattern for high INFP. I'm an anomaly in the INFP. She said, how is it that you have survived and been able to engage in this kind of activity and be a public person on top of that? And we talked a lot. And the only thing I could come up with is that I had a very loving family that said, Nick, you're good, you're okay, it doesn't make any difference what happens, we love you. And I believed it. Now, why did I believe it? That's another issue. We might get into that tomorrow. Why do we believe we're loved? And why do these people then up here not believe that they're loved? Not only not believe they're loved, but actively engage in causing non-love and believing that the world is a hostile place, and if they're going to get anything, they must be aggressive, and the egressor into every situation. And I put this in terms of when you feel intruded upon, the abnormal reaction of the prison person, again, mainly men, is to feel empty and hollow and bored with life. My, yes. And my experience has told me that that can happen prenatally, and that that's where that happens.
That what can happen? I didn't hear what
the inability to feel whole or the inability to feel that there is no bottom to your pit happens prenatally. Now that's, again, on a clinical, that's my experience of what's happening with these people. That they are born, the extreme form of these people are born into probably a parent who is also psychopathic. Who, when I was training in the juvenile system and working with young women who had children, they were 16 to 19 years old. It was a diagnostic center in California, so we were doing some diagnostic tests on them. My experience with the women there was the children who had babies, and then just extrapolate that out to when they become adult, had babies in order to fill their own vacancy. They didn't have children in order to give. And they expected that these kids were going to become like little dolls that they could hold and hug and were going to fill them up. And I'm not a parent, so I'm not a parent of lots of psychopaths. But you who are parents know that that's not true. That there is just tremendous demand placed upon you, and if you're sensitive to it, there's lots of fear in that demand that you cannot meet. And then what do you do about that fear? And then what do you do about when your child gets sick and cries all night long and you feel helpless and impotent and frightened? And the fear is not only for the child, the fear is also your own fear if you're sensitive and you come to terms with the fact that, oh my God, I'm not God. I cannot meet this child's need. I hate this child for presenting me to myself for what I am. I am not capable of dealing with this. And if you don't have some reflective capacity to get out of yourself, and if you don't have some love in yourself, you don't have some support, and a whole history of a family behind you that have taught you how to relate and what meaning is, you can become psychotic around that issue. Some mothers go into post-birth kind of stuff when that happens. The impulse to get rid of that needing child is right in front of you and suffocate, kill, shake, break the neck, something happens. Now that's then associated with the emptiness and the hollowness that's inside these men. That, how do you feel? How do you make a fill up a vacuum, give a person an identity and meaning that they were born without or they had stripped away in their early years? And I say this is early years from 5 years old, you know, from nothing, from inception to 5 years old is when this whole thing takes place. Now there's also some testing that goes on that says that there's also some problems with the brain with some people. Like we are finding with autistic children now. That with autistic children, there is definitely something wrong with part of the brain. It's not just a psychological phenomenon, and it's not because of the way they were treated by their parents. This is some abnormality.
Would a condition like that be inherited? It was something that the person acquires, but it's inherited.
I don't know that. My assumption is it's genetic. You know, like we have blue eyes, brown eyes. That just happens. And
there's a frightening phenomenon, I think, that's happening in our country, at least in research. It's probably been going on for a long time, but we're just now becoming aware of it. It's like in the DSM-3 classification that we use as clinicians in diagnosing. It's only been the last 10, 15 years that we've been able to except the fact that children and adolescents go through depression. I mean, for many years, that was an adult phenomenon. We wouldn't even look at that with kids. What's happening now with a lot of the current research that's coming out, some of the people who work in our center in Billings and Bozeman, Montana, are also related to inpatient settings that work with juveniles. And what we're finding is that there's a growing population, some that have been in the population for years, it tends to get passed on as you're so well describing, is a psychopathic, I'm going to use the word, because I don't know what other word
yeah, right.
at this
yeah,
point.
Yeah.
Teenagers who have developed a psychopathic mind based upon those early years, and trying to figure out some new ways of doing therapy with juvenile sex offenders, juvenile delinquents that have already been tied into the system. And there are some new things out that are real exciting, actually, in terms of therapy and intervention in those kinds of settings. Foster Klein is one. I've never been to Colorado. They've been doing a lot of work and a lot of research in what we call rebonding. Mm-hmm. And at the very extreme that you're talking about, the high end, trying to find ways to begin to, maybe some easier words to understand are like reparent and re-nurture, get at the heart of the hostility. Rage therapy is another, some other terms for that, but to begin to try to penetrate that somehow. But the part that's frightening, and I can't remember the author's name offhand, Tim and I were talking earlier, and it's a book called High Risk, and because I can't remember the author's name, remember the name of the book.
Children Without a Conscience?
That's a good book, too. High Risk is one that's come out real recently. The part that's frightening are the statistical data that's now starting to come out of the inpatient institutional settings with juveniles, in that the growing number of psychopathic personalities is somewhat alarming. It's somewhat frightening. And I guess what is alarming me today is you're talking to resurfacing kind of what is their mindset as we go into that. Whether you're a clinician or not is irrelevant. But the same. The transference of all that stuff daily, but anyway, the juvenile population has been affected.
Well, you see, our society is supporting a lot of this kind of grandiosity and narcissistic behavior. I was talking yesterday about the definition of crime. Street crime in some ways, although it's, you know, it's aggressive and it's hostile and it's debilitating to people, is really not the crime that we need to put people in prison for. Street crime is the kind of crime that happens because our schools and our families and our social institutions have failed. So they have no recourse or resource for finding support, so that when these young males try to enter the workforce, so to speak, they have no workforce to enter. And so their families have disintegrated around them, and they've been raised like Lord of the Flies, if some of you know that book. That's a good illustration of that kind of preying behavior. And so it's a natural response to survival, to go off and rip people off on the streets and to break into cars and break into homes, and that's all street crime kind of stuff. That's the kind of stuff that we focus on. Those are the kind of people that end up in prison, mainly. Mike Milken doesn't, or you know, maybe you will, boasting. That's a whole different kind of crime. The Drexel Burnham stuff, the Wall Street, and the Chicago trading, and the mafia, organized crime. That's the kind of crime that we really need to be concerned about, because that's the kind of crime that corrupts all of us at a very, very basic, deep level. But that's the kind of crime we excuse. That's the kind of crime that we'll let go. The white collar kind of crime is the kind of crime we'll let go very easily, because those people are kind of like us. Now that isn't that. That's the other interesting thing. Getting back to your question, the people that are like us, we are more willing to give leeway to. That's a very important thing to. I'll relate that to something that's happening now in the synod that I am part of out in California, where this homosexual thing is going on. We don't want people in the ELCA ministry who are active homosexuals, because they're not like us. It's very threatening to us. It's threatening to us in our visual concept of what kind of sex act do they engage in. It's not like us. That's the fear. And it's also a control issue. And the the call of the formation of the ELCA has been one, or is one, of inclusiveness. We're going to get hung by that. That's going to hang us. And I think it's a gift to the church that Jeff Johnson and these other guys have come out. Because it's going to make us face up to the fact that we really don't want to be inclusive. Now, then we get back to street crime. Those people aren't like us. We don't want to include them in our society, so we lock them up.
Can I ask a question? What chance does a prisoner have when he gets out of prison to even get back into the mainstream of life?
Well, statistics say that anywhere from 50 to 85, that's a broad range, so it's meaningless. 50 to 85% of the people that come out of prison go back to prison within 3 years.
Well, they have no job, they have no place to go to, they have no. What else can they do but go out and start stealing?
That's right.
Nothing there for them.
That's right. So we're defeating ourselves. Not only that, the more people we put in prison, obviously, the more you're in your own culture, the more you become acculturated. So the more people you put in prison, the longer you keep them in prison, the more they become acculturated to that sociopathic preying behavior, the more that's reinforced. And then you set them out in the street, and 90% of those people come back. The longer you keep them in prison, the longer you indoctrinate them, the more you brainwash them, the harder it is for them to change. And the younger they are and the older they are when they come out. So what are we doing to ourselves? The crime of punishment, you see, as I said yesterday, maybe not so much the crime that we're doing to them, but the crime we're doing to ourselves. Because they come out then and live with us, and they have this attitude ingrained in them, and they got all these friends, and then they go out and they evangelize more guys. Is that what we want? I don't think so. But that's what we're doing. And it's coming again because we don't identify with them, you see. They're not like us. They're not included in our... We don't want to include them. We don't want them living next door to us. We don't want halfway houses in our neighborhood. We don't want to become involved with it. They're not like us. So we're going to keep them out. And that's, again, part of the sociopathic mind that we're part of. We don't identify with them. We don't have a symbiotic tie with them. We don't want a symbiotic tie with them. And in some ways, rightfully so, it's scary. They're unpredictable people. They're frightening people to relate with. Do we want it? And where are we going to get the courage? And that, again, gets back to your question. We can talk some about that yesterday.
I'm afraid of it. They're like snakes.
That's right.
You know, you can never tell when they're going to turn on you.
That's right.
And we've had some very good cases of that in Oregon.
Yeah. But now the issue is that and that's what always comes up, is that when we talk about the cases and the people in the paper and the people that have betrayed and hurt us really badly, it's usually all up here, you see. What do we do with the rest of the people that are down here? We treat them all like they're up here. We don't want to include them. We're so alienated from them. We're so alienated from our own sociopathy that we can't reach out and touch anybody down here. We only reach out and alienate these people up here and let it all filter down. You know, 90% or maybe even more than that, maybe 99% of all people who go to prison, we don't even know about. They never get in the press. Or there's a little line, you know, Joe Blow was sentenced to 14 years in prison for embezzlement for robbery. And the other side of that, what's the crime spectrum? I'm not sure what the statistics are, but I'd be willing to bet you that 50 to 70% of the crime that's committed is non-personal crime. It's breaking and entering, and breaking in without anybody there. When I say without anybody there, it means there's no dog on the premises either.
I just wanted to say something when you just said that that we aren't even aware of our own. I forget what the word you use, but our own sociopathness or our own social situation or whatever that. I was in a program, teaching in a program within the Cook County prison system, and I was amazed at how aware of our, since they are basically considered outside of the system and against the system, how perceptive they were of the system. And they could sit and talk about, you know, how I was buying into the system or the things that were going on in the politics and in the education system and the religious, I mean, everything, that they could sit and even though they considered themselves quite naive and they didn't see their perceptions as anything worth perceiving, that those, you know, maybe we need to really take advantage of their perceptions and see how the system can, I think we need to value their perceptions of our system.
They can tell us some very, very poignant things about our systemized discrimination and violence and lack of integrity towards them. Again, the ELCA is going to get caught in this inclusiveness if it takes it seriously, because we're going to have to come to terms with the violence. And I'm not talking necessarily about the violence towards minorities. I'm talking about the violence towards people that institutions do because of the way they're set up. Even with all of the rules we have now for appeals and for inclusiveness in terms of hiring, you know, people of different color, whatever they are. The kind of attitude that we as the controllers, it's not just white males, it's people who have power for however they have it, and the systematized violence that we do in terms of excluding awareness, that we do not have to listen. Basically, it's a listening skill. We don't have to listen, because we got control. We don't really have to understand where they're coming from. Again, and that's a sociopathic behavior. What's going on basically with sociopaths is, as you said, bonding. There's no bonding going on with them. And just visualize it in terms of the umbilical cord. There's no energy going back and forth in that umbilical cord that says there's an attachment. There's no mores, feelings, recognitions, commitments going back and forth that I owe something to you and you owe something to me. It's all give me, do me, for me, want me. And it's impulsive and it's quick and it's insatiable. Now, a lot of us have some of that behavior in us. I mean, we're, you know, again, getting back to your question, that's what Jesus came to tell us a little bit about. Maybe we can talk about that tomorrow. Where are we on this continuum? And how do we fit in? And what is the scripture, is the scripture mainly talking about? The theology of Scripture is talking about sociopathic behavior. The ability to our ability to disassociate ourselves from not only God, but from one another, and to put ourselves in God's place. That we are the center. And that's what the psychopath is. He is the center of the universe. So as a theological problem, it's the most poignant and, again, technically the most exciting problem we've got, because there it is right in front of us. There's God. There's the idol. You know, walking right in front of us. And how do we identify with that idol? And of course, the quickest way to identify with an idol is to reject it and then incorporate it sneakily through the back door. I'm not one of you. You're not me. Which says, I'm doing to you what you do to me. And therefore, you're wrong, and I can persecute you, and I can use you, and I can abuse you, and I can feel safe and secure and holy. And God and I are one, and you're nothing. And that's a terribly, terribly blasphemous position for me or any of us, I think, to be in. On the other hand, what they do and how they act towards me is so alien, is so offensive, that it's just terribly, terribly hard for me to see how I'm doing that to other people, because I'm not doing that to other people. But I've created systems that then do that to them, because we know we got all these people starving on the, where, south side of Chicago? We got them living in the Tenderloin in San Francisco. And the paper said yesterday that we're going to have 14 million homeless if we don't do something pretty quick. And we're going to become like Tale of Two Cities if this thing keeps going on. And there's going to be somebody sitting there stitching away, counting about how all us good middle-class people who had control of society were buying new cars and new organs and new buildings and new mimeograph machines and new computer systems because we needed to have a good lifestyle, and we knew it was essential for our lifestyle. And these people are dying in the streets. And pretty soon there's going to come so many of them that they're just going to come breaking into our homes. And that is the sad part of it. That we have the resources. The churches have the resources. If they just said, we don't need a new pipe organ. You know, we don't need a new building. And what we need maybe is two more pastors, but we need to take all that money. But can you get people to give money for that? That's the other issue.
No.
No, we're getting into tomorrow already today. The character disorder mind is a mind that is so deprived. Does depravity come out of deprivedness? That's a question that I would ask you. I would say yes, they're related. They are so deprived that in order for them, I get my kick, I can get a kick and get my exhilaration from standing up here and talking to you. I'm the center of attention for an hour, 4 days a week. That's an exciting thing for me. I can be enervated and happy about that for a long time. For them, the center of attention needs to be on the front page of the newspaper, and it can be decapitating somebody's head. That's how depraved they are. I can get a charge out of having one drink of scotch. They need heroin and crack and something else to do it. They need stimulation. Now, if you've ever been around some of these people, and we all have, they're stimulating people. They can be extremely stimulating, and you can want to hook onto their coattails and take off them. And they can lead you a merry chase. We have a lot of these people are in public positions. That means ministry. We got some of these people who are ministering, they're narcissistic people, and they like the attention, and they like the TV evangelism, some of the stuff that's been there, that's part of that. The Bakers particularly are just par excellence example of sociopathic behavior. Sociopaths will cry a lot when they get caught. When you catch them, they'll cry, oh, forgive me, and they'll go through the whole, they're like little kids. Their emotional maturity is somewhere between 5 and 15 years old. Now, some of that emotional maturity, if you want to look at it down in this spectrum, somewhere around here, is their emotional retards. And they're emotional retards that take them sometimes 15 to 20 years to catch up. And then they catch up. I mean, we see that happen. We see that happening in the prison system. When the guys get to between 35 and 40, they stop coming back. You know, is it because we do such a great job in prison? No, we don't do such a great job in prison. We do a bad job in prison. I keep waiting for the day, it's probably never going to happen, when somebody gets out of prison and they got enough smarts that they're going to sue the prison system for making them come out worse than what they went in for. I mean, that seems to me to be a viable option to get some attention and to get the community to take recognition of what they're doing. That I came out worse than I went in for, and if I went into a hospital and you did that to me, I could sue you. So I'm going to sue this community for making me come out worse than I went in for. When they come out and they don't start coming back, it's because they got to be 35, 40 years old. There's a drop-off rate there, just a dramatic drop-off rate. Does that say that something connected inside them? One of the other reasons they don't come back is because they're dead. These people get themselves killed and maimed and hurt and abused and used in the same way that they abuse and use them. That's the other thing that people forget. They do the same things to themselves that they do to the people. So that it's not like, you know, they're not paying a price if we need them to pay a price, so to speak. They're paying a tremendous price. See, if you look at these people, you see that they're you know, their teeth are falling out. It's just very common for them to have loss of fingers, loss of toes, scars. They're the oldest looking young men you'll ever see in your life. I remember one guy, he was in one of the maximum security lockup units, and he said, Chaplain, I'm getting out. And I said, oh yeah. And so we worked through all that. He was getting out. 3 weeks later, I came up there, and there he was. And I said, John, what are you doing here? You just got out. He says, oh yeah, Chaplain, but it was so much fun. I just couldn't stop. I went 24 hours a day, and I couldn't sleep, and I was having such a great time drinking and whoring and having such a, oh, it was just great. And finally, my parole officer just gaffled me and brought me back. Now that's, again, an extreme, you know, end of the reality, but that's what's going on with some of these guys. They just can't, they don't have any internal turnoff, they don't have any boundaries, they can't, you know, turn themselves off, they can't control themselves. And somehow then that thing catches up later on. But by that time, many of them are dead, they've caught diseases, they've abused themselves so badly. And then the other thing that happens, that I just kind of put together for myself, and then I'm hearing about as the literature's coming back, is when they get into there and they finally stay out, they lead just the most boring lives. It's almost like they burn themselves out, but it's really got more to do with skin. It's again because of the emptiness inside themselves.
Are you also saying that to fill this void within themselves, they also have addictive personalities, so that they turn to alcohol or drugs to try and fill, or something else,
yeah,
to try and fill that void, so many of them have those problems too?
Yeah. I think in almost all of them, you'll find some kind of what we would call addictive, and we're beginning to recognize that you can be addicted to all kinds of stuff now. Adrenaline is one of the things that many of us are addicted to, you know, the workaholic stimulant. That's another form of cops and robbers.
Do you think, too, something I've often wondered about, because I worked in with employment service, that this, they don't get, many people, if you're not, and your parents are not, you don't live in certain areas of the city, let's say, or your parents don't have the money to put you into a better school system, then you get turned off when you get about age 10, because you're not being challenged to learn, from the lack of interest seems to drop off at age 10 from males mostly, and then that's when they begin to lose the interest and don't go back to school. And then when they do come out of prison, maybe they learn something in prison, but when they try to get into that field, they're quickly told, well, you were in prison, you know, they may hire them. They find out 2 or 3 days later that they were in prison, then they say, well, we can't keep you.
That's right.
And this is the constant thing. You say you're forgiving society. You really forgive your fellow man for the wrongs they do to the society, but yet and still you never allow them to atone in any way. You will not allow them to work when they have tried earnestly to get a skill to become a part of your society. So how, for, you know, you perpetuate and put that person right back as fast as you can.
That's right. That's
and you create on your, our society really creates these people.
Right. And again, see, we can't include them. We can't identify mm-hmm. with them. We will not accept them as part of us. So we exclude them. And the most extreme form of that has just come out is what happened to Jim Wright's top number 18 in the mm-hmm. Congress. There is no forgiveness in our society for what you do, you see.
No.
And we just, and how many people were, you know, were delighted about that? Quote, good Christian Lutheran people. Son of a bitch deserved what he got.
That doesn't even only happen with people that are being punished for something. That whole phenomenon of people not being able to keep jobs happens if someone in Chicago, there was a, I mean, he looked like he was really well dressed and he was very articulate, but his address was in a very low income neighborhood, and every time he filled out an application, they would go from where he lived. And he had never been incarcerated, he had never been in trouble, he had finished school, but he said, they won't give me a job just on the basis of where I live. So there's like this parallel of a prison or a jail system just within a neighborhood system and a housing system.
Yeah, those are all institutional forms of violence that we don't identify with, that we insist upon keeping outside of ourselves.
In the courts, I'm not sure I even know how to ask this, but how is it ignorance, or is it, how deliberate is it that we seem to fail to differentiate between the guys at the top of your line and the guys in the middle? I mean, the guys who you've implied that some people need to be incarcerated,
but
most don't.
Most don't.
And how deliberate are we in the court system, in passing out judgment, whether it's in the parole board or wherever, in keeping those guys who shouldn't be in there in there?
Yeah. We're very deliberate with it because we're creating the most money spent in our society now, besides being put into the Defense Department, is prison. Prison is an expanding industry. If you want to, you know, get a career, go to prison. You're going to create a career. I was involved in helping create some of the prison system for the 80s in the state of California. And we projected how many people we were going to have and what we were going to do about it and all that stuff. Well, we projected we were going to need, California prison system was the largest in the 70s, and we projected it was going to be the largest, and it's larger, and when I say largest, we're talking about the world. We're not just talking about the United States. We've got 85,000 in there now. They're talking about 135,000 in 1992, talking about a budget of $4 billion. Now, that says that money is coming out of education and human resources and healthcare. And what other things? Vocational ed. Just, you know, like the yellow submarine, just. And we think it's, I mean, we as society think that's okay. And part of it's because of the fear. I mean, there's got lots of good reasons for that happening. So I just don't want to say that's you know, it's just there.
Does mandatory sentencing have something to do with the question you just asked?
Thanks for mentioning that. Mandatory sentencing in the change of the law from the indeterminate sentence, now we're getting into some of the history of prison systems. This is next year's the 200th anniversary of the Walnut Street Jail. I'm on a board of prison history. We're going to celebrate that in terms of trying to make some awareness, and we're trying to gather all the people who know about prison and prison reform for a conference in LA and then a conference in San Francisco, and we're trying to put out a paper, and we're going to try and put out some brief pamphlets so we can start doing some dissemination of this. At first, we were going to offer a prize, a $10,000 prize, to anybody who was, and a $10,000, a $5,000, a $2,000 prize to people who were willing to write papers on the history of the prison system in the United States, the Grand Experiment, it's called. In the United States, and then get all this information and do it. And the people that we sent out to start investigating did it. We were going to do it through the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. That we sent out to investigate and talk about this, who I think know something about it. Incidentally, the people that know the most about it are the American Friends Service Committee, Quakers. Of course, they were involved in the founding of the Walnut Street Jail. So were the Lutherans, by the way. So were the Episcopalians and Presbyterians. So it's our baby. Charlie Manson was in one of our foster homes for a while. It's our baby. He's also in a couple other religious foster homes. We discovered there weren't very many people who knew much about this. So there was no sense in offering prizes to put out papers, because there's only about 10 to 15 people in the whole United States that know any damn thing about prison and who've been working on it consistently in a diligent, systematic, intellectual way at all. So what does that say about us? Again, they aren't part of us. We don't even know about them. So we're going to gather all these people, we're going to put up, and we don't have to offer any money because they're willing to come for free. We're going to pay their expenses. And then there's going to be a big, so to speak, recognition. We're planning to do something on Alcatraz. Have a dinner and some kind of stuff there. I'm lost. Oh, the indeterminate sentence. The history. The pendulum swung all the way over to care and treatment, starting in California with Duffy, who was a prisoner at San Quentin, the warden at San Quentin, and then went through the late 40s and the 50s and the early 60s, and then when the drug stuff started hitting, I want to make some expletives about what the hippies did to us and how that stuff is. And, you know, Timothy Leary was a parishioner of mine. I had some great conversations with him, and he's talk about some of the things that, not particularly him, but what happened with that, the whole drug thing, and what it's done to our society, and, you know, now the craziness that's going on. We got a drug czar. And that's, if that's not an anomaly of pretentiousness or craziness, I don't know what is. Why don't we have a peace czar, or, you know, or a rehabilitation czar or something? We got a drug czar, and we're going to fight drugs, so to speak, but we think about kill drugs. You know? I'm sorry, that's my prejudice and anger. And that the indeterminate sentence was a sop, and it was, you know, it was coddling these prisoners, and that the reason that they were, we had so much problem on the streets because the indeterminate sentence, because they were sentenced from one to life, and that this threat of the parole board over them was causing all kinds of disruption in prison, and that these guys needed to have, another thing about sociopaths is they want immediate gain. They don't understand tomorrow. So that they're saying, we gotta give these people, you know, and that's the bell. But anyway, we turned it to the determinate sentence, and all it did was keep people in prison longer. And it's a lousy way to go. It's just a lousy way to go. I'm sorry for that.